Hey, real people. I am Mandy Wolfswinkle. Welcome back to Real Stories, Real People. I am super excited to be able to share with you today an episode on the podcast with one of my nearest and dearest friends, Dr. Shaylee Horseman, whom I have literally known since we were toddlers living a couple blocks away from one another. Dr. Shaylee is the founder of Denver Counseling Group and is a psychotherapist who specializes in pediatric emotional intelligence and self-regulation. She specializes in children, adolescents, and adults who are suffering from things including but not limited to stress, anxiety, depression, self-esteem difficulties, ADHD, management, defiant behaviors, and those going through the process of divorce. She also specializes in psychosomatic symptoms like IBS and other digestive issues, and symptoms of stress like headaches and persistent muscle tension, and so forth. Shaylee has worked with people from all over the world, studying and analyzing movement and nonverbal communication. She currently works with the community through the family court systems, local homeless shelters, and in private practice. Shaylee continues to advocate the importance the body has on an individual's psychological functioning and strives to improve the lives of others through holistic and creative methods. And that's kind of what we took into our episode today. We talked a lot about trauma, childhood trauma, self-regulation, and really spent a lot of time talking about healing through connection and storytelling. She talks a lot about how the body and the mind work so closely with one another and is able to tell us a little bit of the science part of how our bodies work, but really just focuses on that connection and storytelling aspect. And so it's been really fun to get to hear about this from a psychotherapist point of view. Storytelling obviously is what we are here for, but it was really nice to just sit and talk to somebody in a different light with a different perspective. So I'm really excited for you to hear our episode today. With that being said, before we get started, I have a little disclaimer. This show covers a wide variety of topics related to mental health and life in general. It also discusses topics such as rape and sexual assault. These topics can be difficult for some people, so use your best judgment when listening to the show. We are not therapists, counselors, or mental health professionals. Information shared on this show is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Never ignore professional medical advice because of something you heard on this show. So without further ado, here we go.
Welcome to Real Stories, Real People, a personal journal, mental health, and self-improvement podcast where we're shattering stigma one story at a time. We're committed to talking about the tough things in life so that others can find hope. So tune in and hang on, because here we go.
Excited to have you here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
For those of you who don't know, Shaylee and I have been friends since we were literally 3 years old, 3 and 4. So this is really fun for me to get to bring her on the show today to talk with you guys and share her experiences as a doctor and just be able to give you some insight that we haven't gotten on the show before. So I'm excited. So go ahead. And I know a lot about you, but my audience doesn't. So tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, my name is Dr. Shaylee Horseman. I live here in Denver, Colorado now, where I've established a child and family counseling practice here, where I focus mostly on helping children develop their emotional intelligence and capabilities in dealing with life stressors and sometimes processing out some trauma, adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. I'm sure you've heard that term before, so that they can grow up and function in life to the best of their abilities. I grew up in Sioux Center, Iowa, till I was about 15. And then I had some family things go on where I was moving around a lot. But yeah, I primarily grew up in Sioux Center, so I know the community. Yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Well, the reason why I was most excited to bring you on is that you just have
a very different perspective on some of the things that we have talked about this season. And so I thought it would be really fun or just enlightening for many people to hear about the more science side of our trauma and our nervous system, and just kind of wrapping it up. When we had talked about this before, and we kind of talked a little bit about this before we started recording, but we just talked about how connection is the key to healing. And so I'd be really interested for you to talk a little bit more about that, because this nonprofit's goal is really to shatter the stigma of mental illness and mental health, and to just get people talking more about their stories. And that's what this podcast is all about. And so I just would love for you to tell us more about connection and how that really intertwines with trauma and healing.
Yeah. When I think of It Could Have Been Me and the episodes that I've listened to, it really speaks to storytelling, right? And storytelling is about connection. It's about sharing one's own experience so that it can be related to others and their own inner struggles, right? And here's a quote that I like to keep in mind about storytelling. It says, "The greatest need and most difficult achievement is to find meaning in our lives. This isn't an easy task and doesn't come about naturally at a certain age. It's a long path towards psychological maturity that takes effort. It's also the most important and difficult task in raising children and helping them find meaning in their own lives." And I think storytelling is a beautiful way that can just innately foster meaning in oneself and in others.
Absolutely. And I feel like, I don't know, even being able to get vulnerable enough in your families and with your children to have those discussions. I think that, you know, we were raised by a generation who they just didn't always tell us about their own stories growing up because they wanted to protect us, or, you know, everything was kind of kept behind closed doors. And I remember, not that that's bad, you know, when you talk about not wanting to fight in front of your kids, or when you don't want that to be something that your kids hear. I do think that there is something to be said about saying, yep, we kind of lost our tempers and we got out of control and this was why. And then for them to be able to see you making amends and making up for that. I just think if we told more stories within the confines of our own homes, I think that that would have a great impact on our children and their makeup as they get older. I don't know what you think about that, but.
Well, yeah. And not only just personally, but collectively speaking too, right? Yeah. And in fact, we did have a lot of stories growing up. When we go to church, we hear stories of the Bible, or, you know, if we weren't religious and we heard stories from mythology or through fairy tales or stories in books at school, those were beautiful moments that helped us resonate and begin to develop meaning inside of ourselves. And that doesn't change as we get older. As we get older, stories are just as important. So, you know, storytelling is innately psychological, and it has been since the beginning of time. We see it written on the walls of caves, stories, right?
Right.
So that's just an innate part of our life that is super psychological and helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the storytelling connects us in a way that we start having mutual trust with one another. I guess going into, you know, connection and healing, and you're going to talk about that in a little bit as well, but just the fact that there's, you know, when you are connected to somebody and you have a bond with somebody, that is the beginning of healing yourself. Only because if you don't trust who you're talking to, if you don't trust the people that you're telling your story to, it can have the complete opposite effect and the healing won't happen at all. In fact, it could do more damage. If I'm talking to somebody who I feel is going to take my story and run with it and start rumors about me or tell other people, then those are the times when we kind of close ourselves off and we stop telling those stories. So it goes both ways in that respect, in terms of being able to open yourself up and be vulnerable to people and share with them. And when you don't feel like you have that, you don't feel like you have that trust, it can be more devastating. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's the beauty of things like fairy tales and stories from the Bible and stories from mythology is you can resonate with a character. You can resonate with a theme like loss or death or love, these grand things that are so hard for our brain to conceptualize, right? That cause a lot of suffering.
Yeah.
And so the healing begins, and this is where the connection part happens, is once we've been heard, whether in a character in a story or with another person, there is a validation that says, ah, okay, my story, my experience is legitimate. It's real. Where do I go from here?
Yes.
Right? The foundation of, and that's what it could have been me, right? I think that's a beautiful collective thing that's happening with this organization, is it's doing that storytelling. It's allowing for that validation to occur.
Yeah. When you say that, it made me think of this quote that we used on our Instagram page. I'm looking it up here a second. And it's a quote that I've kind of kept with me for kind of my whole life. And it says, being heard is so close to being loved that for the average person, they're almost indistinguishable. That's a quote by David Osberger. And I just feel like that is so beautiful, because personally, like for me, when somebody is hurting, especially when it's somebody I love, you want to fix it. Like you want to help them. You want to be the one to ride in on your white horse and make them feel better. And really everybody's just longing to be heard. And that's it. Not everybody wants us to fix things. They just want to be validated. They just want to know that their perspective is important and it matters, and not feel shame around it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to remember that, of course we have that natural inclination to go in and swoop in and prevent someone from their pain, or particularly our children, right?
Yeah.
Preventing them from feeling something painful. But we have to be careful about our messaging, right? To ourselves and to others, is the goal of life is not to promote this idea that there is no pain, that life can go on without pain. That's just not realistic, right? It is being with someone in their pain. And that's part of the journey. That's the best we can do as a parent, as a friend, as a lover, anything like that. That's the best we can do, is be with them in their pain, not try and prevent them from their pain. That's their story. That's part of their path, right?
And, we've talked about Sam DeCosmo was one of the, I don't know if you happen to listen to her story, but she was on here a few weeks back, and she talked about having these headaches. She had a headache that literally never went away for like 16 years. Mm-hmm. And talking about how much pain she was in, obviously physically, but that, cognitively and mentally, it was worse because nobody believed her. She would go to the doctor and they would tell her, well, I think it's stressed. I think you have depression. I think that's why you are getting all these headaches. And she would say to them, no, like I'm depressed because I'm in pain. It's the other way around. And even when a doctor finally figured out this is what you actually had and this is what you were experiencing, even just knowing that her pain was validated, that she was heard and somebody believed her, immediately helped her start the healing process. And then she talks about how, I had to find a purpose for my pain. And so, yeah, I think that it's so important that we don't lose sight of the fact that pain is a symptom that something deeper is happening. And so it's what physically or emotionally or mentally, how do we work on what's deeper? Because the pain is just telling us that there's a problem, So if we don't have the pain, we can never fix what's in there. And I'm sure that has a tie mentally as well. That's obvious physically, but mentally, I'm sure the same thing applies.
Well, yeah. And mental, when we think of the mental space, it's not some abstract idea, right? Our mental experience is encapsulated within our body. So as you share her story of having headaches or having these physical pains, that's our soul's signal to us saying, hey, something isn't right. And this is my way of alerting this to you. So if we approach our pain or our symptomology with curiosity, rather than this just needs to go away or this just needs to be fixed,
right?
It's a deeper connection to oneself and to soul, which is ultimately our how we want to live our lives, not disconnected or disembodied, but connected to. And one way of doing that, the arts are great for that, not just storytelling, but, you know, a soul's expression can be done through painting, through dance, through meditation and mindfulness, through yoga. And that's my specialty, right? Is somatic manifestations of psychological disorders, right? Or psychological pain, which is headaches or fibromyalgia or things that are manifesting physically, right? So this idea of mental health as just this abstract idea disembodied is a fallacy. And it's an unfortunate outcome of our Western culture too. Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So tell me a little bit more about that. Like, you are, this is what you do. This is your career. This is your heart. Like, talk to me a little bit more about the, you called it somatic
psychology.
Okay. Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about that and how that helps in the healing as well.
Yeah. That's a very big question. Somatic psychology is this idea of a body mind yoking or a body mind connection that, you know, when you and I were growing up, we didn't have that knowledge. We didn't have the neuroscience to back up this idea that, you know, our lived experience is through our body, not through this abstract, you know, concept in our mind. And so you can see someone's lived experience through their small gestures of their body, through their breathing patterns, through, you know, pain that they have in their body that doesn't have a medical backing for it. It's just there, right? And so if we can get back to this idea of, well, our psychology is really expressed and felt through our body, then we are much more grounded and integrated with ourselves, which ultimately does reduce symptoms.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's just a really cool way of thinking about healing in terms of things. I mean, just how much better you might feel cranking up the music in your car when you're going for a drive or dancing in your kitchen, or for me, it's writing or just putting, you know, pencil to paper or finding gratitude or things like that, and how that can just also help with the healing process. Talk to us a little bit about how trauma can get released through connection. We've talked about storytelling and how it's super important for us to find validation in ourselves through other stories and through whether those are real people or whether they are characters in a book. But talk to us a little bit more about the science-y part of that and how sharing stories can release that trauma that's stuck in your body from.
Well, as I said earlier, I don't want to get too cut and dry with the science about this because it takes out the magic of like the human experience, right? So I'd like to go back to the storytelling part. And I think that feeling isolated in one's own story contributes greatly to modern suffering, right? We can all resonate with that, where we're sitting in our kitchen or we're sitting in our bedroom, just sitting with something alone, unable to reconcile with it or unable to really know what to do with what we're feeling. So,
Especially in COVID, like we're talking isolation, like this is it. And this is probably like a time when people are recognizing that more, you know, we living in Western society also, there's a badge of honor for keeping yourself as busy as possible. And so some of us never get the opportunity to just slow down and experience what that feels like either. And so isolation has been a big part of COVID in 2020 and 2021.
Yeah. And I think one way we stay isolated, not only by what's currently happening with COVID, where we have to, you know, physically be isolated from others, is by relying solely on pure psychological terms, which are too dry and limiting to express one's experience, like I am depression or I have depression. And as a psychologist, I say sometimes these labels are helpful in limited circumstances, but I want us to be very careful here that this is such a tiny, tiny way of expressing our story or our lived experience that I wouldn't want to reduce anyone to that, right? So I want to keep this sort of magical, numinous aspect of storytelling alive rather than getting too scientific about it.
Keep talking about it.
This idea or this statement, like I have depression or I am depression, which is very limiting, may have some truth to it, but it surely, as I was saying before, doesn't encapsulate the entirety of one's experience. So you know, our goal, and hopefully through these stories, is to find a new language that speaks to soul, that speaks to something deeper, which is in itself healing because it can contain psyche and speak to its truth, right? So when I say soul, when I say psyche, it's this part of our own lived experience that is beyond rationale,
right?
And we all feel connected to that in very different ways, but we do need to find ways to let soul speak or let psyche speak, which helps us with the healing process. And as I was saying, storytelling can be one way of doing that.
Right.
So here's an example, right? Think of this. So think of like people like Jane Austen or other 19th century novels that people have read and still do read.
Right.
How do you think the housewives of the 19th century contained their psyches in their oppressed conditions of being a woman at that time, right? They read novels. They had stories in which they could hold what was happening to them and give them expression in a safe way,
right?
So they didn't feel isolated. They found ways through literature to say, hey, yeah, that's what I'm experiencing. That's, you know, that's my story too. And that was validating and healing just in that step itself. So that's why people like Jane Austen were so important and so vital for the time and still today.
Yeah.
There's a collective truth to that literature that still speaks today, right?
I never really thought of that. Like, I never thought, I mean, you're right. In that time period, you know, fortunately, we live in a time where I can have a conversation with my girlfriends or I can talk to somebody else. And it's not taboo necessarily to talk about the things that you're struggling with within your families or with your spouses or friends or whomever. But back then, I think you saved face, right? Nobody spoke of the things that were happening. And they probably all knew that some of these things were happening with other people, but God forbid you ever mention it or speak of it because that could be very costly, just very
well. And that's what's still happening today. It is
absolutely
true. That things are still repressed and considered taboo, particularly around mental health, which is, you know, our whole, you know, my whole purpose in life is to advocate for that. Right. And that's why I'm speaking to you is to contribute to, hey, this isn't something that needs to be quote unquote to save face or to be repressed. That is not respectful to the human condition.
Right.
We need to find ways to express these things and, There are these collective or societal things that still are happening that can repress our voices, can repress our stories or our experiences. And we want to work against that.
Absolutely. The mental health thing obviously is a huge part. I mean, that's really the whole part of what we're doing. It could have been me, but, and talking about how so many different facets come together. I mean, it's not just depression or anxiety. I like how you talked about labels being very limiting because it's very hard for certain people who have never experienced things that, and I'm not saying, I want to be very careful how I say this because everybody has a story and everybody has pain and everybody experiences things differently. But for somebody who's never really had chronic depression or anxiety, it's hard to really put yourself in their shoes and understand what could be causing it. Sometimes it's a major event. Sometimes it is sexual assault or teen pregnancy or, you know, childhood trauma within your home life or you name it. Not all of that gets attributed as being part of your mental health. Like we just look at depression or anxiety or bipolar or schizophrenia, or, you know, we look at the names for these conditions and we don't really look at what were the things that caused it. So yes, storytelling is also very huge in that respect because that is all encompassing. It doesn't just limit you to the word depression or the word anxiety. And I think even as somebody who has it, sometimes it's easy for me to not get stuck. Stuck isn't the right word I'm looking for, but it makes it easy to have it as a cop-out to say, well, I have depression. You know, when I'm feeling crummy, it kind of takes away your responsibility in fighting for your mental health and fighting to get back to where you are because you look at it in certain points, especially when I'm down or when I'm in a low place, it's very easy for me to say, well, it's just who I am. It's just how my brain works. It's how, you know, so it can be limiting, yeah, for myself to get healing and to get better when I, so
yeah,
I like that you brought that up.
Well, this, you know, I want to stick with the stories for a little bit, but on a side note, yeah, these experiences that we have like depression or anxiety, you know, they're multifaceted. They don't just come out of nowhere. And, you know, part of our upbringing, you know, it encodes our nervous system and it encodes how we relate to people, how we digest information, how we respond to stressors. It's not just right out of nowhere where we feel hypoarousal or hyperarousal, which are ways that we relate to when we come up against stressors, right? And depression is a stressor on the body, right? And so hypoarousal is like feeling flaccid muscles, lower heart rate, not able to get out of bed, these things that where our system is not regulated, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, these don't just come out of nowhere. Our childhood experiences and who we've related to in our upbringing and what we've experienced is create the development of our nervous system to be able to cope with these things. Right. So, you know, that's why I come back to the nervous system a lot is it's yep. anxiety and depression isn't just this abstract thing. It's literally encoded yep. in our biology, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes when we're adults, you know, what happened to us, and this is a common phrase and common understanding, what happened to us in our childhood is not our fault, right? But what we do with it when we're an adult is, you know, is part of our path, right?
Yes.
Path forward and part
your
of
feeling
our
is your responsibility.
Yeah. Yes. And so, you know, I can share a little bit about my own personal story with that in a little bit, but I wanted to come back to the stories because
I'm very good at getting us off of the topic.
No, because there's just so many things to talk about. But I'd like to, you know, similar to adults sharing stories, right? And the archetypal stories, right? The stories of the Bible, the stories of mythology that have been since the beginning of time. Similar is the concept of stories for children, right? It helps give them expression to their inner world and thus begins the journey of developing meaning in their lives. So stories enrich lives. They stimulate the imagination and helps develop an intellect that helps clarify one's emotions, right? How we can relate to characters yeah. and things like that. It's like, oh yeah, that's what I'm feeling too, where maybe previously we didn't have the wording to right. name what we were experiencing, right? And to be attuned to one's anxieties, aspirations, and difficulties. You know, that's the beauty of stories too.
Yeah.
The beautiful thing about stories is that we see shared human experiences since the beginning of time, shared things like grief, loss, love, and even envy and shame, these very difficult things to acknowledge, things that are hard to rationally explain away, but can be much better understood through stories, right? Stories from mythology, from the Bible, from literature, from each other,
right?
So it's just has much more weight to it, stories do, than rationale sometimes.
Yeah, I've never really thought about, I mean, storytelling in general, yes, telling your story or sharing your story, but I've never thought of it in this way of like stories that we all know and stories, but that is, you're spot on with that. That is one of the first ways you connect to how you're feeling. And especially for me, I have a really, really hard time putting to words how I feel. It's a lot easier for me to look at a story and say that's what I feel. Like that is how I am experiencing this. And I have done that forever. And even as an adult, that's something I can't always put into words how I'm feeling. And so to say, oh, you want to know how I feel about God or how I feel about this story that I read, this movie I watched, this article I took, those are how I'm feeling. I just can't tell you that in words.
Exactly. And there's even personally for me, there's a movie out there that I'm like, nothing I could ever say or explain could adequately express how I feel about yes. my life. Right. And this movie says it way better than I ever could.
Yes.
Right. That's the beauty of art. That's why art is so vital for our well-being, any art form.
Oh, I right? love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, stories remind us all that the struggle against severe difficulty in life is unavoidable, right? It is this intrinsic part of our human experience, right? So we're not Pollyannish about it, or we don't, you know, pretend that everything's all light and all amazing. That further increases symptom, right? Because it increases discord
yes.
inside, right? And yep. so the more we can be authentic and real about the truth of the matter. And that's why Brené Brown is so big, is she's like, hey, enough of this pretending that this isn't part of our human experience, of this shame, of this, you know, pretending not to be vulnerable. And that created so much discord on us when we kept, you know, living life that way. So that's why her work was just so eaten up, right? It's like, yeah, this gives appropriate credence, I would say, to where we need to be.
Well, and especially when chances of all of us going through something, I mean, yes, life ebbs and flows and sometimes you're doing really well, but really for the most part, when we don't, like, we're doing a disservice to each other by not, you know, sharing or by not just being authentic. You use the word authentic, which is one of my favorite words, just because I don't know how not to be. And so when I can feel, I mean, we feel each other's, we kind of know when you're talking to somebody and they're not being authentic, or you know that it's, they're just putting on a face because that's what we do. It's very hard for me to work with. Like, it makes me feel very anxious, and I just know that I have to wrap up the conversation quickly because I don't know what to do with, I don't want to call it fake. I just don't know what to do when we're not being our total selves. And so the issue I find is that most of the time we're both going through something, and I'm not talking about like using it as a vent session or that every person that you come across, you have to spill your guts, and that goes back to the trust thing and being able to know who you're talking to and being able to trust that who you are with will hold your story. So, I mean, there's a boundary there as well, but I just feel like the more we give ourselves permission to share stories, the more we give other people the same permission to be real as well.
Well, yeah. And, you know, when we come up against something and when, you know, you're a more feeling intuitive type, you really pick up on things that are below the surface a lot, right? And there's a lot of people out there that are like that. We work with kids that are considered highly sensitive individuals, and it's really a gift, right? But it's helping parents and helping educators understand how to help this child develop with their skills, not repressing them or, you know, hiding them as something that's not helpful or not needed. But what I always say is when we stay in a curious position, even when we're talking with someone that they appear to have a persona going on or a mask of some kind, I always ask, I wonder what they're experiencing that would cause them to feel like they need to put on the mask. And that in itself then is a shared real experience, right?
Right.
Where I don't have to play into their mask or their persona. It's like, they must feel a certain way that would cause them to have to do that. And we all have our masks. We all have our personas. And that's how we can stay connected, is to ask that question and to be in that curious position all the time, even with ourselves, being, I'm feeling this way. I'm noticing these sensations in my body. What is this about? Rather than, oh, this is bad, or, you know, I need to get rid of this, or I'm going to ignore this, right? That's an unhelpful position.
Right. What I like about that too, is there, I mean, this is just something that I try to tell myself all of the time, is there's not a person you wouldn't love if you knew their story, you know, like this, when you say that, it reminds me, okay, there are, especially like as a teacher, you know, there are always those kids. There are kids that are just hard. They maybe have some heightened behaviors. They're hard to reach. They seem disengaged all of the time. And when you realize, okay, those are probably the kids that need the most of me, the best of me, they are probably experiencing something that I have no idea about. It automatically makes me more empathetic. It automatically makes me have just more of a heart for them. And I think when you separate that, when you look at their behavior, as opposed to looking at, okay, their behavior is a reason, there's a reason, a deeper reason. And it might not be something I ever find out. We might not be in a relationship where you would ever tell me what that was. But if I change my mindset to saying there's something, there's a reason this person is doing what they're doing, saying what they're saying, And it might hurt my feelings and it might not be okay. Like what they're doing may not be okay. But if I come at it with that perspective, it makes it a heck of a lot easier for me to come back with compassion or empathy, as opposed to putting up a wall and pushing away that connection that could
be. So think of it as for us adults, right? How even now it's really hard for us sometimes to find the words to tell our story, right? Or find the words. Think of being a 5-year-old or a 16-year-old, where they have less faculty and life experience to find the words to tell their story, but they are telling you their story. They're telling you through their behavior and their actions and their resistance and their defenses. And if we can look at them as that's not them, that's the pain. Let me connect to the pain, right? Let me see them as a human experiencing something difficult that hasn't yet been worded, hasn't yet been understood. You're right. That fosters connection in and of itself.
As as somebody who works with kids that have this on the regular, would you say, like, how would you tell, and not even just kids, but how would you tell somebody, maybe it's not somebody that you have a relationship with, maybe it's, you see this pain, you see that there's a reason for the behavior. How would you suggest connecting, making a connection with that person in a way that feels authentic and doesn't feel like you're overstepping a boundary? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Make sense?
Well, I always go back to nonverbal, right? We certainly can't force someone to share their story, especially if they're young and they don't even know what they're experiencing, right? Or they don't have the words. It's about, the three basic things, even how we treat a toddler or an infant who's dysregulated or upset. It's eye gaze. It's slowing your own breath, opening your own heart and your own energetic field to provide space for them, and lowering the intensity in your own body, because they will not be able to be regulated, meaning they will not be able to change their behavior until they can feel a connection.
Yep.
And it's our job as parents, caregivers, teachers to allow that space without filling it up with words sometimes. And even though we're advocating for storytelling now, there's also times where just a space needs to be provided. Saying, hey, I see you, without saying this, but you're nonverbal, saying, hey, I see you. I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. We're in this together.
Yeah.
And that could be while they're tantruming on the floor, you sit on the floor and you open up your own body. You open up that own energetic field and say, hey, I know you're struggling right now. It's okay. Without saying any of that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, those are key things, even as adults, when you're with a friend, not jumping into fix it mode, but joining them in that space of saying, my heart is open to you. My mind is open to you. And I don't need to fill the space for you. And you don't need to fill it either. We can just be here. And there is a science behind that, behind why we do that, which is fostering connection on a much deeper level than just what words can do too.
I love that. It takes the pressure off of the person who's trying to be there as well. Because I think Ashley and I had a conversation on one of our podcasts about how that's what makes it so hard sometimes to get people to open up and to share, or not even share, just to open up in general, is you don't know what to say. So when you go and you say, hey, how are you? Most of the time, people are not asking you that question, expecting you to be honest about how you are. Because if we were honest, most of the time, a lot of us would not say, hey, I'm good, everything's great. But that's what we say because, one, we don't know if the other person was really ready to hear how we were feeling. And two, we don't know if we're prepared to tell them what that was. So to be able to just say, you don't have to have words and you don't have to have an answer, but just you showing up, just you doing these things that you're saying, these nonverbal, these just holding space for somebody, just make more difference than I think we really give it credit for.
And, in a different context, we could think of, a child or a friend, let's stick with the children for a minute. If they're displaying like undesirable behaviors or they're acting out, they are telling you a story, mm-hmm. right? And how can we hear that story with curiosity and empathy rather than judgment and criticism? Because that certainly doesn't help us
right.
move towards resolution by any means, right?
Yep.
And so, and how we treat ourselves is reflected on how we treat other people. So if we are very critical of ourselves internally and very shaming and damning of our own story, then that's going to be reflected on how we treat others too. So it really, things really start internally with ourselves too, of how we want to engage with others, how we want to engage with mental health and our lived experience. Right.
Sure. Yeah.
And you know, a lot of these unhelpful stories can be encoded from our childhood, right? Like you can't be this, or you can't be that, or you can't feel this, or you can't feel that. And that has to be all unlearned.
Right.
To be able to come back to what's real and what's authentic, which is, yeah, sometimes I do feel shame and sometimes I do feel this or that. And that's the reality of it, right?
Right.
And there's a curiosity of, okay, what's this about? Let me listen to this. That's where the healing journey, right? It's yeah. really curiosity. And I keep saying that over and over and over
again. Which is good. I mean, we need to hear that over and over so that we also internalize those things as well.
How we grew up, I certainly remember, I don't want to speak for you, but
right.
there wasn't a lot of space. And this is just culturally, right? Too.
Right.
It wasn't just where we grew up. It was culturally and where the progression of science was at the time too. We didn't have a lot of the neuroscience to understand the importance of someone's lived experience or internal world or emotionality, which is considered affect, right?
Right.
So what we know now, which is very helpful, is that affect or the lived expression of emotion in our body, right? Not just some abstract thing,
yeah.
is really at the core of our being. It's a measure of our heart. It excites us. It deflates us. I'm talking about affect, emotionality.
Yep. Yep.
It connects us or it distances us to in relation to others. And it precedes our intellectual capacities. Here's a really interesting thing that we often promote our intellectual abilities, right?
Right.
And I want to have a child and really, I want them to be intellectually advanced and successful and all of that. And we focus on the academia of the individual, even within ourselves. But what we know now through science is that our intellect and our rationale and our ability to analyze and interpret things is solely dependent on our emotional brain. It contributes to our sense of our emotional brain contributes to our sense of agency, authenticity, and well-being. And if that's dysregulated, our intellectual mind, our rational mind is offline. It's not even working.
Right.
Right. So it behooves us to consider not only within ourselves, but with our children, hey, let's develop the emotionality, the emotional intelligence of our child, of me, so that we can function on such an optimal level.
Tell us a little bit about ACEs.
So ACEs is adverse childhood experiences. And although our hope is to not have those, it's actually unavoidable. Right. So when we think of trauma, we need to first correctly identify trauma. Trauma on a pop culture sort of idea is like this one big event that can destroy our ability to manage life, right?
Right,
when
right.
in fact, that's just one definition of trauma, but trauma is much more complex than that. And ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, I like to think of them as paper cuts, right? You get like one paper cut or two paper cut and it hurts, right? And it's, but over time, people can experience a lot of paper cuts, a lot of adverse experiences in their childhood that add up.
Right.
And when they add up, it does damage to how our nervous system responds to life stimuli, responds to relational things, responds to stressors. And we have difficulty in adulthood managing life. And that could be constant feelings of anxiety and feeling unsafe, or constant feelings of depression and feeling hopeless. These aren't, again, as I said before, these don't just come out of nowhere.
Right.
And so personally, I'm a great example of this. I grew up in a home that was extremely chaotic and emotionally neglectful, psychologically abusive. And I had to do, and still do, therapy, but I had to do a good 15 years of intensive therapy to reprogram my nervous system. I was incapable as a teenager of relating to people in a healthy way and to managing stressors. I was constantly dysregulated and choosing behaviors to self-medicate, right? When, you know, I was doing the best I could with what I had, and I had no guidance, no people that really saw me or understood what I was going through. I was alone in it, right? And so, you know, once I entered college, it was like, okay, this is what my experience was. What am I going to do with it now?
Right.
And I decided this was going to be my life's work. It was partly to heal myself from a lot of the damage that had been done growing up.
Right.
But also, okay, this was my wound. What do I want to do with this? And it became my life's work. And hence here I am now, but it is a lot of work. It's not something that can just with a snap of a finger be, you know, changed. It's a constant tending to self or tending to soul, right? That is, you know, if this is part of your life's, you know, your life plan or your life view, is you constantly tend to soul, you constantly tend to self, so that you can be on this journey of continuing to find a way to be, find homeostasis inside of yourself.
Don't you kind of feel like this is something maybe I experienced? You get to a point where, you know, it's almost as if you're like outside of yourself a little bit. Like, I know the things that I'm doing that are not healthy for me. I know the things that I'm doing that are not contributing to getting better and to healing, but there's a disconnect in actually doing it. Like, I just find that even doing the work, your mind and your body are so used to doing things or experiencing things in a certain way, and how you respond to trauma or stress or anything. And when you're in a good place, and I say in a good place, when I'm feeling healthy and I'm feeling like I can handle things, because my depression and anxiety comes and goes very quickly. I can have sometimes it's hours, sometimes it's days, sometimes I can have really, really good moments, and then anything can trigger it and I can go back into this place. And I recognize it. I recognize what is happening, but I can't always fix it in the moment. And so, you know, I don't know if I'm really asking a question other than just saying that that exists, and that even as an adult who is going to therapy, who is working on it, it is not an easy fix by any stretch of the imagination.
No. And, you know, we, as I said before, it's hard to live a life without adverse experiences, right? And so we're going to have our wounds, we're going to have our complexes that will be with us, right? Through the rest of our lives. It's that constant compassion towards it of like, oh, here I am again. Okay. That's okay. Yeah. Right. And sometimes we'll make different choices in that moment, and sometimes not. And that's the human experience, right? So to remove any shame or, hey, I should be doing better by now, or I should be more capable at dealing with this by now. It's encoded in our DNA. It's encoded in our story.
I think it's very helpful even to hear that. Not that I've never heard that before, but just having to keep reminding ourselves and each other, like, you need having more compassion, being compassionate of your experience. And I don't know if that's just the way everybody grew up with the, you should do this, you shouldn't do this, or if you are feeling this way, or if you choose to do something in this way, you're not healthy, or I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to say other than when I am gracious to myself and when I'm showing myself compassion, I am a lot, I'm probably going to get out of that state a lot quicker than if I sit and kind of ruminate in shame or guilt or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, because ultimately some of the things that we choose to do in adulthood that are coping strategies that are maladaptive, meaning not healthy or not helpful, maybe it's temporary relieves the pain, right. But not over the long run, is we probably used those things early on in our life that saved us at that time.
Yes.
That was our only way of dealing with something, right? We can say thank you to that. right? And now I'm working on different ways, right? Now it's not as helpful, but if it still happens, it's, you know, that's, it was helpful in the past.
And I, that was something, and it's funny that you say that. Maybe three or four weeks ago, I don't even know what happened, but like I said, little things can trigger it. And I happened to be scrolling on my phone and I came across this quote that said, the worst part about anything that's self-destructive is how intimate it is. You become so close with your addictions and illnesses that leaving them behind is like killing the part of yourself that taught you to survive. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's why, especially the older you get and the more experiences you have, like it is very, very hard to get healthy or get well because you've become so comfortable in these things that have essentially saved your life, even if they are things that also brought more pain or more destruction in different ways. I think that's very hard when you're in a pattern of addiction or in a pattern of trying to get better, and just it almost is an out of body experience because you're doing something that feels so foreign to you, even if it's helpful, if that makes sense. So,
well, yeah, it's a, you know, when we fall into those patterns, we're ultimately abandoning ourselves. Right. And when we think of addiction, it's in depth psychological terms, it's known as, you know, an attempt of someone to find their spirit. That's why we go to spirits, like the alcohol, we're going to spirits to attempt to connect, right? In, you know, eating disorders, it's an extremely compulsive, shaming, neglectful disease towards self, right? It's an abuse of the body, or in other terms, this is very academic, but an attack on our feminine, our sense of our feminine, meaning our body, right? Whether you're male or female. So these addictions and these compulsive patterns are, you know, seen as neglecting of self, right? So how, the question is, when I see myself in that pattern, how can I return back home? Right. How can I return back to my soul? And what does that look like? You know, even how one's development of one's nervous system is connected to generational stuff, right? Yeah. Because our parents do the best they can with what they have. They have their own ACEs or their own experiences that they bring into now how they relate to the child or how they relate to, so looking at my parents, right, they did the best they could with what they had, but they, you know, they didn't have the wherewithal or the know-how of, hey, how can I raise a healthy, well-adjusted child? What does that look like? And what are her emotional and psychological needs, right? They don't ask those questions. That was a whole different generation. Even our generation, we're just now asking those questions, right? And so these are how things can get passed down in our physiology, in our biology from, you know, they did studies with, you know, Jewish people that were in the Holocaust, right? And they still found trauma responses 2-3 generations beyond that.
Wow.
Right? So, you know, it's trauma can happen, and how our nervous system is developed is relational.
Right.
Right. So how our parents relate to us, particularly, you know, when we were kids, if we were dysregulated or upset or dealing with something that was beyond our capacity to manage it. Right.
Right.
When we're in those moments, how parents relate to their children is vital to the development of their nervous system. Right. And to the development of how they feel about themselves. Right.
Yes.
If growing up, if I was experiencing something that was stressful and I was acting out, or I was, you know, doing something that my actions were not okay, or I guess not okay, but just I was acting out, right? You know, if I got the message that you're not allowed to do that, or you're not, I don't know, whatever it is you're experiencing, shut it down, go calm yourself down, and then I'll talk to you when you're ready.
Right.
That teaches a child nothing about how to deal with stressors. And in fact, it imprints on them, oh, I'm bad when I have big feelings, or I'm bad when I feel anxious or unsafe, right?
Yeah.
And those messages then are the foundations of my sense of self, and then how I relate to others and eventually my children, right? So that's the multi-generational thing of how it things can get passed down just physiologically, right? Until we decide to do the work ourselves to repair some things so that we don't pass things down to our future generations.
Well, and I feel like even as you say that, you know, there are, again, things that I think that was just the way that it was. And maybe that's all I knew. Maybe that's all I saw with my friends or with my family. But you just, yeah, if you're acting out, especially if you're acting out in a way that is very public, like you're in the grocery store, or you're, you know, when you act in a certain way, when you're not allowed to have those feelings, or, you know, I think even as parents, I don't feel fully equipped. I know all of these things. I could, you know, I could tell other people what to do and what not to do. But even for myself, when our kids get into a place, and I think as toddlers and younger kids, it's more of just the acting out, throwing a tantrum. And I remember telling my kids, I'll talk to you when you calm down, but we're not going to talk about this until you can, you know, but not giving them the tools or the resources to be able to do that. Or, you know, I just, you do the best you can at the time. And, but even now having teenagers, this is like a whole nother version of, as a parent, I find often Dan and I lead out of fear, like whatever we're scared of, whether it's me projecting, not wanting my children to have the same experiences as high schoolers as I did, whether that be teen pregnancy or alcohol or, you know, anything that I experienced as a teenager. And so it's very easy for me to want to say punish, just like give consequences or have conversations where it comes out of big fear and don't do this and don't do that, and not really sitting down and listening. That I find I have to very often go back and say, okay, I handled that the way wrong way. Can we have a conversation about this? And I do that all the time. And so maybe a question for you is for parents, when you see, or you're trying to talk to parents about changing that narrative and changing the way we do things to unlearn some of the things that we were taught or the way that we were raised, how would you give advice, or what would you say to parents who are struggling in that way of changing how they are doing things now as parents than what was done to them to like break that cycle maybe?
Yeah. Well, I think a major key step is understanding what's your story and what's your child's story, and to not get them infused with each other, right? That's just projection. We're projecting onto our children that they're going to do this or they're going to end up this way, right? But that's really our story. So if we take back our story, right? And this is the beauty of this program too, is, hey, I get to further understand my story through shared experiences, right? This impacts your ability to parent, because you start to own what is yours rather than placing it onto your children. And then you're not coming from a fear-based place. You're coming from a curious place, which is, I constantly come back to that, is, okay, what is their story right now? This was my story. I don't need to come out of that and place it onto them. They have their own written story. What is it about? What is it that they're going through?
Right. Yeah. And I think when you're able to step back and see it in that way, and I love that you keep using the word curious and curiosity, because I think it changes how we think about this. You know, as a parent, well, am I being a good parent if I don't make sure that they know that this is not good? Which is funny, because I think every teenager would tell you they know what's right and wrong and good and bad. You know, like, it's not that my kids don't know what's right and wrong and what's good and bad. So for me to say, make sure you're not drinking tonight, well, duh. Like, they know. I mean, that's not going to necessarily change the fact that they do or that they don't. But yeah, when you're coming at it, you know, why are you making that call? Did you feel peer pressure at the time? Was this your way of coping through something? And I think just coming at, you know, more of a questioning, like having a conversation, keeping the dialogue open. And if you are parenting in a way that your kids feel like coming to you will help me as opposed to get me in trouble. Mm-hmm. I think when you set the tone for your dialogue and what you're expecting, I do think that you you change that story a little bit and you break that cycle of holding things inside and not being able to be honest and real and authentic.
Yeah. And you know, I keep relating how we relate to ourselves and also to our children. It's the same as we really want to step out of this black and white thinking of good, bad, right, wrong, right? That's just not the reality of things, the reality of life, right? So if we can say, okay, what are our drives? Like we have drives, we have urges. That's part of being human. If we can fully accept that, and also that in our children, it takes out this sort of damning or this shaming response that we might have to them in some of their choices, right? More as, oh, I understand that you wanted to be included, or I understand that you went to this party as a teenager because you wanted to feel liked, or you wanted to feel attracted to, or you wanted, these are normal human urges and drives. I get that,
yeah.
Right? Let's be in that together and let's talk more about that rather than, oh, you did this at a party or you drank to do this. Like, that's wrong. You shouldn't do that. There's no growth opportunities in that.
Yeah. And that brings upon the shame and the guilt and that also puts up walls and prevents you from doing the work of even allowing our kids to reflect like on their own, you know, think about it. I think that we naturally do those things, but I think just giving, not even permission, just talking about it. Like I talk a lot about myself in the morning trying to get ready for my day and how I am better throughout the day if I've given myself time to sit and find gratitude in the morning or just sit. I'm not great at sitting still and meditating, but giving myself some time to do nothing or to just reflect on the day before. I think when we do that and we show our kids, that is healthy for me. It's healthy for my mind. You know, we teach them that that's a normal thing to do is to reflect on what happened and why did I do that? And what was the reason that I chose to do that?
And that it's okay.
It's okay
that it's even though a behavior might be undesirable, that's not what we're focusing on. And that shouldn't be our focus in raising children and how we relate to ourselves. It should be more like, what was my lived experience at that time?
What can I do? And what,
yes. Yeah.
Can I grow? Yeah.
So I talk a lot about what's called happiness hygiene. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
So it's the idea that, you know, it's similar to other hygiene, like our body hygiene or our teeth hygiene. Happiness is just the same. It's not a given. Right. And we have to do things to promote it. And there are specific things that we can do to tend to our happiness hygiene, right? Yeah. And there are things like sit for 2 minutes and we know the science behind this now. Sit for 2 minutes and do a gratitude practice, right? Or sit for 2 minutes in complete silence and connect with your body, right? Connect to your felt sensations. What are my arms feel like? What are my legs feel like today? What does my gut feel like today, right? Yeah. Take a minute to send a text or an email to someone thanking them for something, right? Or showing appreciation for something. There's these things that we should be doing and also teaching our children to be able to cope with life.
Yeah.
That contribute to our happiness hygiene. It's not just a given.
Kind of as we're wrapping up, is there anything else that we didn't get to that you feel is really important to share?
I think, you know, part of this whole program that we're doing is to pay attribute and pay credence to the importance of our inner world.
Yeah.
And our inner experience and these things that are ungraspable, right? These aren't rational things. Our soul and our psyche and our inner world are not rational things, right? They're things that are very nuanced.
Yeah.
And how can we pay, you know, attention to and tend to these aspects of our human condition that are vital for our well-being, right?
Right.
It's much more nuanced than what we think. Some people connect to themselves and connect to their felt experience through art, sometimes through religion, sometimes through physical practices like Tai Chi or yoga, sometimes through a vocation or an ideology that they want to contribute to their society. There's many, many ways we can connect back to ourselves. Storytelling is also one, if that really resonates with people. but it's just important that we consider and value our inner experience.
Yeah. And I think that's what I take away from this conversation, is just the importance of connection in so many different ways, and how that really is the start of healing. And so I really appreciate your perspective. Before we go, though, I do have a couple of questions that I want to ask.
Sure.
The first one being, if you could go back and tell your younger self anything, what would you tell her and why?
Oh, gosh, that's such a good question. I would tell her a few things. I would tell her, one, that everything you're ever going to need is already within inside of you, and that you're much stronger than what you think. It's okay what you're feeling, and that you're not alone.
Oh, I love that. I love that everything you need is already inside of you. Mm-hmm. That's, we just have to access it. I love mm-hmm. that. We talk a lot about in Real Stories, Real People, how getting our stories out is super healthy and good, and sharing them with the world is shattering stigma, but also bringing it back to finding joy. And how do you do that? And so I'm wondering, what brings you joy today?
Oh, what brings me joy today is to be able to talk with you and share part of my life's purpose, which is to continue to talk about and consider our psychology and our lived experiences. So I'm so grateful to just be here and to talk with you about this stuff.
I'm just so thankful that you decided to come on today to talk more about this. I think that it is going to be incredibly enlightening. There were things in there that I knew, but hearing them again in a different light just makes me want to go back and reflect on things and think about them differently. So I just really appreciate you coming on today. Thank you for giving your time and just sharing with the world things that you're passionate about. So thank you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Mandy.
If you're loving the latest episodes of Real Stories, Real People, we'd love it if you'd leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcast, or find someone that you can share our latest episode with today. Together, we can shatter the stigma. There's more to come next week. Stay tuned.